The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 23, in the Gateless Barrier. Huainang, neither good nor evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Taiyu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huang Mei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, let us both call Huang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." And then Wu Men's verse. "It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." Sometimes something bubbles up that's been nagging you for a while, and finally you shine the light of awareness on it. And for me, it was Huainang's teaching. That there he is, standing, facing this big, strong general. No doubt scared. And what does he say? He says, "Don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" And what I've been wondering is, why does he say those two things? Are they just the two random things that came to mind in the moment of panic? Or is there some connection between "don't think good, don't think evil," and that question? What is your original face? Don't think good, don't think evil. The sutra tells us that this dividing the world into good and evil, into right and wrong, is the mind's disease. And Huainang was pointing to it. And we see it arise everywhere. This morning, during Qigong, when David was introducing to us that we should cartwheel our arms in different directions, and he started out by saying, "Don't think good. Don't think evil." And Bob had great satori and sweat poured from my body because suddenly I realized that I had been making Qigong into good and bad. I had, when we were cartwheeling our arms just one at a time, I was thinking, well, is this 360 degrees in my right arm? I really, you know, the left arm, the rotation isn't quite so good. I was measuring. And then, the last 3 days, when David would instruct us to try to do each arm in a different direction, I was completely lost. But, rather than just staying with my lostness, I realized that I had made up a whole story. I'm pretty old. My coordination isn't very good anymore. A story about Bob. About good and bad. About being good enough or not being good enough. And of course, that's just one tiny example of how the mind grabs on to good and bad. This and that. Right and wrong. How many of you have found yourself not wanting to, but sitting there criticizing yourself for bowing at the wrong time? Criticizing your neighbor for shuffling or stepping on your heel? The mind of right and wrong jumps up. And this praise and blame, right and wrong, can't be evaded by just staying with the praise. Well, I'll just stay with the mind of praise. I'll pick out everything I like and I'll say how good it is. I'm remembering when my son got his first job after college. He was working in his job for a couple of months and then he came and said, "Dad, I don't think they like me." And I asked him why. And he said, "Well, they don't say anything about my work." And so I asked him about it. I said, "Well, are they giving you more assignments?" He said, "Oh yeah." I said, "Are they inviting you into more projects?" "Oh yes, and in fact they want me to, more people want me to work with them and I'm getting more assignments." And then it dawned on him. He said, "Nobody's been giving me any praise. When I get my report in on time, nobody's saying, 'Good job.'" And then he said, "Oh my God, all I had to do as a kid was show up for a soccer game and I got a trophy." He said, "Nobody's praising me and I don't know how to feel about myself." So, even the praise carries with it the shadow of blame. Even the right carries with it the shadow of wrong. The mind's disease. So what's the connection with our original face? Well, there's a wonderful poem by Rumi that some of you may know. It goes like this. "Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to speak about." What he points to is that when we don't divide ourselves from the world, measuring, evaluating, and we lie down in that grass, it's a whole different experience of being alive. Think about the moments you've had in the garden here, where you just take in the coming forth of flowers and plants and stones and koi. Now think about going at the garden this way. Oh, that leaf is a little misshapen. I really don't like the color of that flower as much as that one. And I wish that the spots on this koi were just a little bit different. We don't do that. Thank God. Because most of the time there are circumstances where we will allow ourselves to bathe in experience, be in experience, be one with it, and the evaluative mind does not kick in. And I get glimpses of that. David and Melissa talked so beautifully about being stuck and getting unstuck. And I come up against the iron wall of my evaluating, scolding, shaming mind over and over again. And then I will get a glimpse of a gateway through that iron wall. I will get a glimpse of a freely flushing toilet. And know that yes, that's there. That experience of the self not thinking good or evil. That is there, and that I can see it, I have experienced it, and there's a longing. What I notice arising in me is a longing for a way of being in the world that doesn't put that shrink wrap of plastic over everything that's the evaluating mind, but simply being there. And so, I simply do what we are enjoined to do, which is to observe and observe and observe. Shine the light of awareness on this evaluating mind. Know it as part of what is, as part of what arises. And with more and more intimacy, to know the possibility of the world and the self that is too vast to speak about. And now Melissa will speak about it.
Nah. Oh, okay. Maybe I will. I was very touched by what Bob said about how the bubbling up occurred around this line. I think that's something that we can rely on. We're setting up all of the conditions for the mind, which preoccupies itself endlessly with the old narratives, whatever they might be. It gets a new narrative, new words to obsess about. You might say that koan practice is a very intentional offering of rumination around something that isn't, thank goodness, about me anymore. And then it becomes about me because it touches the heart. So this question that Wei Nung asks Ming, don't think good, don't think evil, at this very moment, what is the original face of Monk Ming? They're very connected statements. They're very connected questions. They're connected because everything that Bob said about good and evil is the very thing that prevents us from seeing our original face. And the original face, as Wu Men says later, has nowhere to hide. For some reason, I was thinking as, I think I've said when you're going second in a Dharma talk, you have to focus on everything that your fellow teacher is doing, but also keep thinking, oh, I could extrapolate on that. And then, probably I missed half of Bob's talk, the half I heard was great. So. But I kept having these little sputterings of, ooh, that, ooh, that, ooh, that. And what kept persistently arising for me, in the same way that what arose for Bob was this particular line, was a memory that I had around the shadow side of the narrative and of these self-defeating narratives, this good and evil setup that we're constantly doing, praise and blame, this and that, right and wrong. I was training in a hospice program to learn how to do bereavement counseling, and for a number of years I was a grief counselor. And this was at a local hospital, and I was training to be a volunteer on the hospice ward, which is in this hospital. There were 6 beds where people could come and die, and their families could come and be with them, and the nurses on that particular ward were wonderful, and there were volunteers who then would work with families afterwards. And later, when I was in graduate school, I did a lot more of this work, but I hadn't thought about this moment until Bob was talking about the good and evil. And before I actually go further into the story, the point of this for me is that when we see through good and evil, when we see through praise and blame, which is very hard to do because the world is almost forcing us to do that. You know, we do a thing after Dharma talks where we go upstairs. You might wonder what we're talking about. And the very first thing we say is, good talk. You know, like, what? I don't know. Yeah, good talk. Well, they've all been good so far, right? But what does that mean, good talk? But it's reassuring, and we can go on with our lives and not go into a pit of despair and shame about opening our mouths in front of other people. So it's probably useful in that way. But when praise and blame, when good and bad, when evil and good are seen through, and then, you know, Wei Nung says, and what is your original face? The original face manifests itself as a spirit of connection with everything in the world. When Rumi says, when the soul lies down in that grass, there's a way of letting the grass hold us up, letting the earth hold us up, and we realize that that the consequence of freeing ourselves, even for a moment, for a millisecond, of judgment and praise, of good and bad, frees us to recognize that we are all together in this suffering world and in this joyful world. That we share everything. On a retreat like this one, you may think that you're having your own emotions, your own physical manifestations of tiredness or stomach issues or whatever is going on for you. You may feel that you're having your own insights. You know, oh, I saw the flower today, and oh, the fish flicked its tail and my heart opened. You may feel that that's just for you. But it turns out that we're generating some kind of field where we're all experiencing life together. And when we see our original face, we actually see that our original face is not mine. This is why the traditional question is sometimes, what was your original face before your parents were born? Before this whole karmic thing started rolling, who are you before birth and death, before good and evil? And we hold tight to our individuality because it's a form of protection. When David and I were young, young couple, and we would come home from work and be, you know, exhausted and suffering, or after we had our daughter and, you know, we were just like laid out, we had this little joke that we would do. One of us would start singing, "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen." And if I was singing it, I'd say, "Nobody knows but David." That's the feeling, right? It's just me sitting here, and everybody else seems to be so great. You know that wonderful cartoon of Gahan Wilson of everyone in a zendo, somebody sitting in a zendo, and everybody's sitting up, strong, and you know, he's thinking, oh God, I'm such a terrible Zen student. And then in the next frame, you see from the other side that all of the people sitting are wooden figures. They're just fronts. He's the only one in the sendo. And that's exactly how it feels, right? Sometimes it feels that way for some of us. It feels like nobody knows the troubles I've seen. And this sense memory that came up so fully was sitting in a circle of people in an auditorium in this hospital. And it was the weekly grief group. And I was coming to learn from this, I think she was a Catholic nun. She was the training volunteer teaching us how to hold the group. And, you know, people, it was like any support group. People were going around and talking about their losses, and you could pass, and there were a lot of people there. And one guy was full of anger. I remember he was shaking just really hard, and I kept looking at the nun, the trainer, thinking, what's she going to do with this guy? He was shaking with rage, and he said, none of you know what it's like to lose someone. It was kind of like the most amazing thing I'd ever, in a group of people where everyone had just suffered a loss. He said, none of you know what it's like. And then he proceeded to talk about, I think it was the death of his wife. And I was just like, on tenterhooks, what's this woman going to do with this guy? And she said to him, in my recollection, thank you for that sharing. It must be so hard to feel so alone in your grief. And then she said, who's next? her compassion for not trying to teach him, you know, what are you talking about? This is a group of people. There was something true about his feeling of separation, of his feeling like it's only me. And I know I do the same thing. If you really were interested, and I hope you're not, if you were interested in asking me the story of my life told from the frame of everything I've suffered, it would be a terrible story. I mean, I look like I've got it together, but you know, things happen. And when I later, I'm just recollecting, when I later went to another hospice for training in graduate school, one of the books that was recommended to us to study when we were working with grief was by an author named Judith Viorst, and it was called Necessary Losses. And the book, each chapter is, here are the losses that people experience when they're babies. And then the next one, when they're children. And then the next one, when they're teenage. And it just kept going on. And there were, you know, little anecdotes. She was one of these pop writers. But, oh, I was very touched by that book. And I remember when we discussed it, we all had to read it and come back and talk about it. And it was a thick book because she went all the way to old age and death. I remember the trainer, this was a social worker, she said, so what was your feeling about this book? And I remember somebody saying, and I was feeling, but I was too shy to say, oh my God, I thought I was alone. And what Judith Viorst is saying, like, is that everybody has this feeling of separation. And taking this back to Monk Ming, didn't he have a feeling of separation? Based on the sense of injustice, right and wrong. He knew that an illiterate woodcutter should not be a teacher. You may think that Mike and David and Bob and I shouldn't be teachers and have evidence for why. It's because you do this or you say things like that or I don't think you really get this or whatever. Monk Ming had that feeling about Wei Nung. And, you know, to his credit, Wei Nung's teacher, Hung Ren, never announced to the assembly, I just want to introduce here on my right the best student I've ever had. You're going to love working with him. He's a great teacher. He transmitted to him in secret. And he only announced it the next morning after Wei Nung had left. And so he left room for people to be in the mind of right and wrong. And they went there. Because that's what we do. such a habit. And Monk Ming is our hero, really, in this story, because he went to the mind of right and wrong, and he raged against it, and he used all his energy and all his sense of right and wrong to run for 2 months. And then when he tried to lift that robe and bowl, he couldn't do it. There comes a point in our lives, I can say that this point is a point I've reached a number of times, and then I think, oh good, I've reached it, I'm done. I don't know if this is sadly or fortunately. Circumstances keep arising. And so I get to try again and again to justify myself the way Ming tried to lift the rope and bowl and then have it be too much. I can't do it anymore. I can't maintain this fiction of separation and judgment anymore. It's hurting me, and it's hurting others, and it's hurting the world. It's too much. I don't actually think those thoughts. I just think, oh, can't do it, can't do it, can't do it. And then that transforms into, can't do it. It's not my job to save the world. It's my job to pay attention, to notice what's happening, to dissolve, as Monk Ming did in that moment, the self dissolving, and Wei Nung catches it and says, so don't do what you've been doing. No more good, no more evil. What is it right now? And in that moment, he opens. And then he closes again. He says, wait a minute, did I miss something? Nope. You didn't miss anything, because everything you've been searching for has always been here, will always be here. This is not a secret. How wonderful. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Those who listen to this teaching with a grateful heart, treasuring it, revering it, gain blessings without end. Don't believe it, but revere it. Could this be the possibility for you to open to a life of freedom and liberation from right and wrong? Probably not. Not right away, anyway. But it certainly opens the door, the creaky closed door. It opens it just enough to catch a glimpse. Maybe everything I've ever wanted is right here. And this is what it looks like and feels like and is like. Everything that's ever happened has led me to this moment. Thank you.